Welcome to the Jazz Legends Podcast, which was born out of the jazz evensong gatherings on Sunday nights at St. Michael's-by-the-Sea in Carlsbad, California. Henry Mancini, born April 16, 1924, was one of the most prolific and successful songwriters of all time. His film scores won 4 Academy Awards, a Golden Globe, and 20 Grammy Awards, plus a posthumous Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 1995. He had a lifelong affinity for jazz and jazz musicians, hiring many of Hollywood's greatest jazz players for his recordings and film scores, and his tunes have been embraced by jazz musicians worldwide for their melodic lyricism and intriguing harmonic structure. The knowledgeable jazz musicians you'll hear are Gunnar Biggs, Keith Bishop, Joey Carano, and Bob Weller, and the talk is moderated by me, your host, Father Doran Stambaugh. Dig it. Henry Mancini, when I saw him on the list, I thought, oh, well, he doesn't come readily to mind as a jazz legend.
As a composer of tunes that were recorded by jazz artists, he definitely was one of the biggest ever. You know, but as a player, I mean, I don't know.
He really wasn't that well known as a player. His main instrument was flute when he was growing up in Iowa.
He played piano also.
He played in the Sons of Italy band, and he played piano. And he played piano with the Tex Beneke Orchestra.
Well, I've heard
wrote
him
for the Tex Beneke
piano.
Orchestra.
He sounds good
on
piano.
He was not a bad piano player, but he didn't play piano on his own records at the beginning. He would hire all these great jazz players.
So he was just primarily a composer and mostly a film composer.
Yeah.
100 films, I read.
Well, one of his first big breaks was writing for the television series Peter Gunn. And that was a jazz score. And it's funny because a lot of jazz musicians denigrated the fact that it's like you shouldn't make jazz like associated with crime and all this stuff. There were people that were mad about that. But it became like a very successful recording project. People liked the music so much that they went out and bought the records. And those were his first big selling records.
Wasn't that the first Grammy of the year, album of the year?
I think it was, yeah. The music from Peter Gunn. It's funny because, you know, he wasn't a member of ASCAP at that point. Yeah, ASCAP is who pays royalties for composers. Now BMI is a competing thing. But at that time, ASCAP was like the dyed-in-the-wool composer's like royalty machine. And he wrote to get his music licensed by ASCAP, and he got a nice letter back from them that I've seen published, you know, after the fact.
Yeah.
That, I'm sorry, we don't think your music has really any potential to make any money, so we have to deny you, you know, admission to ASCAP at this point. And he ended up being one of their biggest, like, money makers over the years.
Oh, sure.
But that shows how completely insightful ASCAP was at that point, because he already had these hit records, and he was making a lot of money off these records, and ASCAP said, no, we don't see any commercial potential in your music, you know. But he's also, he's from Aliquippa. He's also like from the Pittsburgh area. And he and Billy Strayhorn are the two greatest students of this guy that used to lead the band at Stanley Theater. They knew each other at that time, and they would be down there for lessons with this guy. And apparently he like influenced both of them to like go into the field that they ended up going into, which is very interesting, I think.
Who was that?
His first name was Henry. I'm trying to blank on his last name. But in Henry Mancini's biography, autobiography that he wrote with Gene Lees, he gives this guy a lot of credit for this guy was apparently like a great teacher and a wonderful orchestrator and like a heavy musician. And I've heard that from a lot of people that came up a couple generations before me in Pittsburgh, that this guy was a big influence. He died rather young, too.
I think I learned to play Peter Gunn on the guitar when I was a kid.
It's possible. It was a popular thing.
It's the bass line, man. Well, you know, I think that the tunes, the quality of his tunes, though, jazz players have always been pretty good at seeing the potential in a tune, whether it was recorded orchestrally or for some film soundtrack or something. What can I do with Days of Wine and Roses, for instance?
Yeah.
I mean, listen to what Bill Evans did with it. I mean, that's now a staple for jazz musicians. So his tunes were commercially accessible, but also aesthetically and compositionally. And the changes were hip enough that the jazz player could adopt it with some jazz damage done to it in the meantime to, you know, do some reharmonization on it. But I think they saw the potential in his tunes. So it was just good writing.
Yeah, like those early tunes, those early popular tunes that jazz guys played.
Yeah,
people of all ages still are into Moon River. That song is so pretty and
well, what he did with Moon River, you know, I mean, if you remember that movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, he really stretched that tune out to make backgrounds for the whole movie, that's a real compositional thing. Hmm. You know, it's not like just playing a tune and improvising on it. It's like he took that tune and used it as a backdrop for that entire movie, you know, in various forms. Same thing with Days of Wine and Roses. Hmm. You know, it was at various places in a movie as background, you know, so it had this whole development that you don't normally see with jazz tunes.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about composing Moon River was it was intended to be sung by Audrey Hepburn, who wasn't, strictly speaking, a singer. So it was a comparatively easy song to sing. And in his biography, he says that he always will regret when they put out the original recording of that movie, of Breakfast at Tiffany's, that they didn't use Audrey singing Moon River. He used a choir singing it. And he was so thrilled with the way she came off in the movie singing it by herself with guitar accompaniment that he really has always regretted not putting that on the original recording. Mm. Another interesting thing about that biography is he talks about when he and Johnny Mercer first wrote The Days of Wine and Roses. Nobody had heard the tune yet. And they went into the studio where they were filming the It was kind of odd that they were writing the music at the same time the thing was being filmed, but they had Jack Lemmon there, and I guess Blake Edwards was the producer, and the female lead, who I'm drawing a blank on. Anyhow, and they all came to hear Johnny Mercer sing the song and Henry Mancini play the song, and he said they didn't know how they were going to accept it or feel about it, but they were all crying by the end of they got to the end of the tune. So Johnny Mercer said, I think we've got it. But that's kind of mind-boggling to think that these are the first people that heard that song besides the composer and the lyricist. And it's been such a part of the American experience ever since then that it's hard to imagine anyone not having heard Days of Wine and Roses, the song.
Right.
But that's the way a lot of his music is. It's iconic, you know, like Moon River, you know, like, is one of the most played, heard standard songs of all time. And it's hard to imagine a time that no one had heard that song before.
Have you guys played his tunes in jazz gigs?
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
So ones that will get cycled through instrumentally, like what are some tunes?
Days of Wine and Roses.
Yeah, I just did it on Thursday.
Really?
Called it a session.
In F.
We did it. I think. Like I said, it was wild.
Well, it's funny, so many people have adopted Bill Evans' version of that. He does it in two different keys, and it's almost like when I don't play it in two different keys, it feels weird to me.
I like that, yeah.
Bill Evans did that with a bunch of different tunes, but it seems like more people have accepted that version, whatever, it goes up a minor third after the first.
I heard Bob Endelvolsen.
Oh, yeah.
Do Out of Nowhere like that, where because of the song, you could split it in half, there's no bridge, and so he did that one up a minor third.
I got to play with Bob a lot with Jack Sheldon's band. He was the funniest cat ever. He would come in every rehearsal with a joke, a different joke. And he was Bob Endelvolsen was like one of the most amazing musicians of all time. Like he was best known as a valve trombone player, but he also learned to play the bass. Somebody needed somebody that could play trombone and bass. He says, oh, I'll learn the bass for you. Can you loan me a bass? And he came in the next week playing the bass. And he played clarinet really well. He played in the Salt Lake Symphony Orchestra as a clarinet player for a while. He was just a phenomenal musician and a great arranger, too. He had a whole book of big band arrangements. And what a funny cat. Anyhow, if we digress.
Has anybody heard Henry Mancini live?
Oh, I did hear him a lot live, yeah. He would come in pretty regularly and guest conduct the Pittsburgh Symphony, and a lot of times I would go to hear them. And he would sometimes play the flute, too, or the bass flute, kind of a novelty. That was one of the things about the film score or the television score of Peter Gunn. He kind of made great use of the bass flute and the alto flute, which weren't sounds that you heard a lot then. And part of the reason I was reading is because they didn't have the budget to have strings, so it's things that he would sometimes write as string lines, he would write for like unison bass flutes and stuff. And it became like a kind of a signature sound in a lot of his film scores. And it's funny because a lot of people have heard that sound but don't know what instrument makes that noise. I bring out a bass flute sometimes and I say, you've probably heard this, but, you know, a lot of film scores, but you've probably never seen one because people, it's a big thing. It turns around backwards.
Plumbing.
Yeah, the Pink Panther soundtrack. Is that, you know, I listened to it a couple days ago. I was thinking about Henry Mancini, and I never thought of it as a jazz tune. I've always thought of it as the Pink Panther soundtrack, and my goodness, it's a jazz tune. Is that something that you guys, have you ever played that?
We did play it.
We played it last year when we did our Henry Mancini thing.
Yeah. If I had a memory.
And Plas Johnson, I think he's still with us. He's 90-something.
Really?
Was the original soloist on the Pink Panther.
Is he a horn
tenor player? Yeah. He was one of the first black guys to become busy in the L.A. studios. And
okay.
He played on the original recording of the Pink Panther.
Okay.
And then the last few versions of the Pink Panther before Henry Mancini died were recorded in London, so they used a British saxophone player on them.
Didn't we do Baby Elephant Walk?
We did Baby Elephant Walk, too.
Atari.
Which is kind of an iconic thing, too. And that was an interesting thing, because originally they were thinking of cutting that sequence from the movie, because it didn't really fit in with the movie. Some European actress, like, walked down to this watering hole with these baby elephants, and they shot a whole sequence of her, like, giving elephants a bath. And he thought, it's kind of like a swing thing, I think. You know, like the way the elephants walk, you could imagine like a swing thing. And so he wrote this thing and brought it in. He says, do you think this would work in this sequence? And, oh, yeah. Like, let's do it.
But that isn't really swung, is it? The baby elephant walk.
It was sort of a swingy kind of
thing. It's kind of a calliope sound.
And then the other thing was interesting. An electric calliope that somebody in Long Beach had invented that Henry Mancini really thought, oh, that's a cool sound. I want to use that in the movie. And that was... That and E-flat clarinet, the guy that used to play lead alto with the Lawrence Welk Orchestra, was a really good clarinet player that played that E-flat clarinet solo on the film score. So it's like just an odd combination of instruments. But it became like...
Memorable.
Memorable from that film, more than anything else in that movie, I think.
Yeah. I don't know how to ask the question. It's trying to formulate in my brain about something about, you know, a connection between jazz music and getting into the realm of film and television score. Does his work do anything for jazz in terms of bringing it into the popular imagination and mind, or does it more push back and change people's understanding of jazz having these... I want to say, not everybody finds, when they think of jazz, they don't think of it as listenable. But then you think about like these tunes that we're talking about now, Pink Panther and Peter Gunn. It's like, oh, well, that I don't think people associate that with jazz. So is there, like, what has he done in his work to bridge a gap?
Well, you know, interesting thing, neither one of those tunes would be jazz standards, you know, the ones you mentioned.
Yeah.
So he wrote a lot of stuff like that was very popular, but it wasn't adaptable to a jazz style. On the other hand, a thing like Days of Wine and Roses is highly adaptable, that style. So a lot of the stuff he wrote was, they were able to adapt it to jazz, but not everything.
Got it.
You know, Baby Elephant Walk, no jazz players play that. You know, and Pink Panther, we play it at a wedding if we have to. You know, it's that kind of thing, you know what I mean?
You could.
Yeah.
Because the harmony isn't.
There's not a lot going on harmonically with that tune. It's true. But the bridge has some changes, but most of it is just like one chord.
One chord. Yeah.
And so is Peter Gunn, for that matter.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty static. But then he wrote like some beautiful tunes for that TV series, Dreamsville. It's gorgeous.
That's a gorgeous tune. Yeah, I love that tune.
A lot of jazz players have played that after the fact. But that his score for Peter Gunn was more jazz-oriented than a lot of his later stuff was.
So he just has a great breadth of ability to write whatever's needed for the TV or film or whatever it calls for. He could do it.
I think so.
Yeah.
I really liked his film scores.
Yeah.
I heard him talk about having to see the movie. He was saying that he was hired to do the soundtrack for a movie, and he had to wait for the film to come in. They usually would give him the script. He says he has a hard time figuring out what he's going to write until he actually sees the actors moving around. And he also mentioned that song Charade, and he said that was one that we sometimes hear songwriters say, well, that came to me in 5 minutes. I wrote that sucker in 40 minutes, you know, and it turns out to be one of their classics. That's one he said he composed it in a half an hour, and it just felt natural, and yeah.
Came quick. Yeah. I appreciate that, being able to see visually what you're writing for. I mean, you can think of themes in all kinds of different ways. You could read a script, and I suppose you could visualize what the music would be like. But I mean, film is such a visual. It's a visual medium.
So. You know, it makes me think that, like, you know, composing is a lot like improvisation, sort of in slow motion. You know, and you have to be, in other words, you have to get an idea and then just run with it. Mm. You know, and not try and plan it out so much. Like they talk about, I hear people talking about this. So you have a structure, you have to plan the whole thing out. But I think in a lot of cases, you just get an inspiration, you just run with it. Mm-hmm. You know. With no planning. And I think that way a lot of the material is a lot fresher. Mm. You know, whether it's like a composition or whether it's improvisation, I think the same rule applies. The structure comes afterwards when you get the whole thing out and then you have to organize it in some coherent way mm-hmm. so that it's listenable, mm-hmm. you know.
But the ideas They're, can be spontaneous.
They come flying right out, mm-hmm. yeah.
With some of these old-time film composers, like if you've watched some of these, I used to have that movie channel that did show all these old movies, and you've watched these old movies, and they're scored constantly from beginning to end. Right. Everything is underscored. Somebody walks across the room, and the violins are playing, and it's like nobody scores films like that anymore. And when you watch some of these old movies, it's like distracting. There's so much music. It's like it's great, but like wow.
Well, and like that reminds me of Tom and Jerry, which I grew up watching, which is an old cartoon. But musically, or however they scored it, the visual had to come first because somebody's sliding around on ice and there's vibraphone.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the king of that stuff was Carl Stalling.
Oh, man.
Carl Stalling.
He wrote the Warner Brothers.
Yeah, Warner cartoons. His stuff was exactly right on with the action on the screen.
Gnarly woodwind parts.
Oh, gnarly. Everything. They had such virtuoso players to
play, his
stuff. I never played any, but I love hearing them.
Yeah.
It's like everybody's such a great player, and Carl Stalling was such an original writer.
The music's incredible.
Yeah. And there's a funny story in Chuck Amok. Chuck Jones was the director of a lot of those old Warner Brothers movies. And apparently when Schlesinger Studios went out of business and sold out to Warner Brothers, they brought in all these accountants to run all the departments. And everybody, all the artists, like just could not stand these guys because they had no idea what anybody was doing. So Carl Stalling used to write every week, would come in with a score that they would record back when they were doing a bunch of cartoons. And the Bean Counter had to like approve the score. And he didn't know anything about music. But he had seen all the artists like checking the cells when they'd finish a whole sequence of cells that flipped them to see if it looked right, if there was something out of place in there. So this guy started watching this and he said, well, maybe that's what I should do with the score. So Carl Stalling would bring in these scores and he'd flip the pages and see the notes move like that meant something. And after a while, the artists started catching on to this. And when Carl Stalling became a score, they'd all crowd around and look in the office to see this guy flip the pages and laugh at him because he didn't know anything about music or art or anything. But that's Chuck Amok.
Well, okay, what else about Henry Mancini? What do we know about him as a person, personally?
I think it sounds like compared to the other people we're talking about, he led a fairly conservative lifestyle. You know, there were no psychopathology, no addiction, you know, nothing like that, no outbursts of temper, you know, throwing anybody off a roof or anything like that. So I think he just lived a fairly, you know, I mean, compared to the other guys, he lived a fairly normal life.
Yeah.
And I think he ended up making good friends with John Williams and Quincy Jones, if I'm not mistaken, they were close. And I think it's probably because he helped them get jobs. I think I had that impression.
Well, the list of accomplishments is significant for a musician, for a composer. But perhaps the greatest piece of scoring that he ever did was the theme for Viewer Mail from Late Night with David Letterman.
Oh, really? Just kidding.
I read that and thought, well, now I know that one. Oh, did you guys say what you're going to play? What you're going to play for the set?
Well, of course we're going to play Days of Wine and Roses and Moon River and Two for the Road and Moment to Moment. And there's some more obscure ones that I like. Sally's Tomato is a tune from Breakfast at Tiffany's that I've always liked.
You know, Dreamsville.
We play. And Dreamsville, we're going to play. And, of course, I did say Pink Panther, didn't I? We're going to play that.
Nice.
Because people like to hear that. And we're going to play Baby Elephant Walk.
Oh, right. Great.
And you're going to be lucky I'm not going to play it on the E-flat clarinet because I'm not going to be there.
That's right. Didn't you play it last time?
I tried to play it on the E-flat clarinet last time.
Did it not go well?
It was a cold day in the chapel, and the E-flat clarinet was not a happy camper that day. It's a thankless instrument.
The Evensong Quintet will feature the music of songwriter Henry Mancini on April 21st, starting at 4 p.m. The weekly Jazz Evensong gatherings are free and open to the public and take place Sundays at 4 p.m. at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. See you there.